This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What I'd like to do today is make our way through the administrative components quickly and then tell you a story that actually began when I moved from, before I moved to Dallas, and has continued over a nearly 40-year period. I have no conflicts of interest related to this presentation or the studies presented. For ACG and competency, we're going to talk about patient care and medical knowledge and tell you how we have identified a problem which neither the obstetricians nor the anesthesiologists, at least in our facility, recognized, but we did once we began to see what treatment of hypotension was. The outline of our talk is going to be a couple of case presentations that will give you a setting for where we're headed, a brief review of the occurrence and outcomes of perinatal hypoxia asphyxia, and you'll notice I never use the term ischemia because the fetus never has an ischemic phenomenon. If you look at the physiology of brain blood flow, the only time ischemia occurs in the fetus is generally at death. And so what they have a hypoxic asphyxic phenomenon, and it's the ischemic phenomenon of Vannucci, which is in seven-day-old rats that most people refer to. We're going to examine the vascular reactivity in pregnancy and placental oxygen delivery. We're going to review a study of fetal risk in hypotensive women delivered by cesarean section with regional anesthesia. And then we're going to ask the question, what can be done? The goals and objectives are to understand the differences in maternal vascular physiology within the uterine and systemic circulation, a very important aspect of the problem that we're going to be talking about, and understand how maternal hypertension affects vascular function, another very important observation that was actually made by Leon Chesley in the 1950s at Downstate Medical Center, and then followed up by Norman Gant at our institution many years later. And then hopefully you're going to be able to appreciate the fetal neonatal risk of regional spinal anesthesia for cesarean delivery in women, especially those with hypertension. And we'll give you a little bit more background about that. So the first case is a 31-year-old Gravita 3 Para 2 woman at 39 weeks gestation who's an A2 diabetic and has preeclampsia. She had a stat cesarean section for non-reassuring heart tones, and her blood pressure before surgery was 150 over 95, consistent with the diagnosis of preeclampsia. But interestingly, it fell to 108 over 65 and then 98 over 55, and she received phenylephrine, a potent alpha-1 agonist, times 2, a total of 200 micrograms as boluses and volume expansion. The baby then underwent resuscitation with endotracheal tube and umbilical vein epinephrine, was intubated, and given positive pressure ventilation. The neonate was a 4,400 gram Apgar score 002, and the umbilical artery pH, and we measure blood gases on greater than 92% of all of the deliveries at Parkland. And let me tell you that Parkland has about 12,000 deliveries a year, and just a few years ago we were running 16,000. So it's a lot of blood gases that are done. But this one showed a pH of 6.8, a CO2 of 112, a bicarb of 17, and a base deficit of minus 25. And by standard criteria, that meets the criteria for perinatal asphyxia. The baby was admitted to the NICU. At that time, had a pH of 7, a PCO2 of 46, so the resuscitation went very well. The PO2 was still low at 34 now. The bicarb was 11, and the base deficit remained minus 20. The diagnosis that was made in this baby was a 15% abruption with moderate severe hypoxic encephalopathy, severe hypoglycemia, and the baby received hypothermia for 72 hours. And what I want to show you in this picture is the two large arrows at the top and the yellow arrow on the side demonstrate that this baby, his mother, got phenylephrine, the potent alpha agonist, twice, and you'll notice there was no pressor response in either dose of phenylephrine. And this woman's blood pressure remained low. So the two things were going on, we know now. One was that blood pressure was low, therefore perfusion to the placenta might have been low. And the baby also did not have a pressor response, though the mother didn't have a pressor response. And that's a potent vasoconstrictor that we'll talk about. The second case was a 37-year-old, gravid of 5, para 4, 38-week gestation woman with marked obesity and pregnancy-induced hypertension followed by preeclampsia. This woman was to undergo a cesarean delivery with spinal anesthesia or regional anesthesia and was volume expanded before the spinal was given. Her blood pressure was 156 over 87, so she too was hypertensive. And notably, following the spinal, her blood pressure fell to 100 over 45, a decrease of 56 millimeters of mercury and a substantial decrease in perfusion pressure. This woman got multiple doses of phenylephrine, or a total of 900 micrograms over 40 minutes in addition to volume expansion. She ended up undergoing a stat cesarean delivery for non-reassuring fetal heart tones. The resuscitation, however, was fairly benign in this case. CPAP of 5 and stimulation. The baby was 5,050 grams. Apgar scores were 4 over 6. So for a term baby, these are still grossly abnormal. The umbilical artery pH was 7, the PCO2 was 98, the bicarb was 23, and the base deficit was 16. So once again, she met the criteria, this infant, for a diagnosis of perinatal asphyxia as defined by the NIH studies that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. On admission to the unit, this baby had a complete response, literally, to resuscitation. The pH was 7.4. The PCO2 now was 48, the PO2 was 45, and the base deficit now was a positive 3, reflecting the hypocapnia more than anything, which would also account for the pH. This baby also had moderate hypoxic encephalopathy and met the criteria for hypothermia treatment. And what I show you in this picture is the multiple doses of phenylephrine that this woman received when her blood pressure plummeted following the institution or induction of the spinal anesthesia. And despite that plus volume expansion, you'll notice that there was no change in her blood pressure at all. So this vasoconstrictor was doing something, but it wasn't raising the blood pressure in this particular case, as in the other. So what's common to these two cases? Well, first of all, both mothers had hypertension. Therefore, it sets a stage for changes in vascular reactivity throughout the body of these women. Secondly, the mother had hypotension in both instances, and therefore there is no autoregulation of significance in the uterine circulation or to the placenta, and therefore as perfusion pressure falls, one can have a decrease in placental blood flow. And internists learned that a long time ago, that when they took hypertensive women and got them down to being normotensive, they ended up with the termination of the pregnancy and a stillbirth. And so no one drops blood pressure in hypertensive women to normal values any longer. Both patients were treated with potent alpha agonists, phenylephrine, which is a pure alpha-1 agonist, and or ephedrine, which is the most commonly used alpha agonist in the world today. But neither of these women had a pressor response. In addition, there was evidence of fetal hypoxia, asphyxia by umbilical cord blood gases, and hypoxic encephalopathy by neurologic exam, and both of these babies required hypothermia therapy. So let's turn our attention very briefly to perinatal hypoxic encephalopathy and what is it and why we are concerned with it. It's a fetal disorder of unclear onset, unclear duration, and severity, usually occurring in 2 out of 1,000 live-term births. So this may account for that substantial population of term babies who have cerebral palsy and whom we've been unclear as to what the pathogenesis has been in the past. It now becomes evident that these babies were exposed to an episode of variable duration of hypoxia and asphyxia in utero, and it may be the explanation for what we'd seen in the past. Notably, 15 to 20% of all newborns with hypoxic encephalopathy will die in the postnatal period, and 25% of the total population of babies with HE will have childhood disabilities. Now, both of these babies were classified as moderate severe, and so babies with moderate to severe hypoxic encephalopathy actually have approximately a 50% risk of death and or abnormal neurodevelopmental outcome. So hypoxic encephalopathy is a major problem in obstetrics and neonatal medicine. And if we put them together, let's just call it perinatal medicine, because it's something that begins in utero and extends out through infancy and then into childhood and adulthood. And although the pathogenesis for hypoxic encephalopathy may be and can be multifactorial, all neonates that have this disease have had inadequate fetal oxygen uptake. And this is what we're really interested in. Where is that coming from? And what's contributing to this decrease in fetal oxygen delivery and fetal oxygen uptake? And this can reflect abnormal maternal placental oxygen delivery during reductions in maternal blood flow, and we'll come back to that point a little bit later. So what is the physiologic explanation for the lack of a pressor effect in these women and the occurrence of fetal asphyxia? Well, we began these studies a long time ago as a fellow in Colorado, actually, and I had the opportunity to learn how to use the chronically instrumented sheep, which is an incredible model that we've used over the last 40 plus years. This is an old picture in an old lab. We're much more modern in the last few years in terms of having a laboratory with steel pins, et cetera, very unique looking. But this is where it all started. These are what the labs looked like. And what this animal model permits us to do is that we can continuously measure mean arterial pressure and total uterine blood flow. And actually, what we've been able to do in our lab is we can do that both in the maternal and the fetal compartment simultaneously if we wanted to. We also can infuse drugs systemically or intra-arterially into a specific vascular bed, and in this particular, say, a uterine artery, so that we get unilateral effects of the drug that we're interested in, and the contralateral uterine horn becomes a control. And we can measure all tissue organ blood flows using radionuclide labeled microspheres, which was a technique that was developed in San Francisco and in Colorado simultaneously in the 1960s and 70s, and I had the unique opportunity to participate in those experiments. And now what we can do is we can collect the arteries from the sheep and compare the in vitro function of those arteries with arteries that we have collected from women, both pregnant and non-pregnant, who've undergone hysterectomy. So what I'm showing you here is that the spiral artery, which is the artery to the cotyledon for the human, has been considered to be a non-functional artery. And I believe that this is totally incorrect. Even though it's been invaded by the trophoblast in the distal end, in fact, the proximal end here is functional. And I'll show you some data from Elizabeth Ramsey from the 1950s that supports that. And then I'll later show you data from our laboratory, which also supports it. But these cotyledons in the human are coalesced. So you see a placental plate, and you see multiple cotyledons that are very difficult unless you are used to dissecting them out and studying them separately. And I'll show you an experiment where that was actually done. Well, what about in the sheep? What do we have? Well, We have a uterine artery, a proximal, second, third, fourth generation. We have a cotyledon, and it's a different type of placenta from that that's seen in the human, but the cotyledons are separate. And we also have the myoendometrial perfusion, just like in the human. But importantly, we have the placental artery, which we can actually isolate, or we can study its flow using radionuclide labeled microspheres. And we're interested in this blood vessel and its functionality. Now, in 1974, in the early 70s, Saul Snyder, an obstetrical anesthesiologist at UCSF, was looking for a pressor agent that might be used in women that would have a significant pressor effect, but with minimal effect on the uterine circulation. And this is a picture of some of the data that he published in 1974. And I just want to point out to you at the top, this is ephedrine. And you can see a dose-dependent rise with bolus doses of ephedrine in women in the pregnant sheep giving a bolus of ephedrine. But there was also a decrease in uterine blood flow, though not as significant as what we see with these other agents. There was a decrease in blood flow. Therefore, Snyder and his colleagues concluded that, in fact, that ephedrine might be the ideal agent since it had a minimal effect in the uterine circulation. In 1977, doing very similar studies, but with new data, new technology, we actually looked at the dose response across a series of doses shown on the y-axis. And you can see that across a broad range of doses with norepinephrine, and we also did this with epinephrine, there's essentially no pressor effect at all. On the other hand, when one looks at the uterine circulation of these pregnant animals, there's a gradual progressive decrease in uteroplacental blood flow, and it's only when there is a decrease of 40 to 60% that, in fact, that you begin to see a pressor effect, suggesting that the uterine circulation is very sensitive to alpha agonists in contrast to the peripheral vasculature, which seems to be blunted. In 1986, with Ron Magnus, who now runs the perinatal labs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we compared intact non-pregnant and pregnant animals. And what we saw, now that we could measure cardiac output and resistance, was that, in fact, the resistance in our pregnant animals, the increase in uterine vascular resistance, always exceeded the increase in systemic vascular resistance, and therefore always exceeded the rise in mean arterial pressure. And guess what happened? Uterine blood flow fell with almost every dose of the phenylephrine. So this is now the second most used drug, and it also is a potent vasoconstrictor in the uterine circulation. Can't find my arrow. But the point here is that the uterine circulation is exquisitely sensitive to alpha agonists, whether it be ephedrine, norepinephrine, phenylephrine, or epinephrine, and that the systemic vasculature is more resistant to it. In 2012, we went on to publish a series of in vitro experiments. And now we're looking at denuded blood vessels. They don't have endothelium, and we're looking at smooth muscle function. And what it shows us that in both the proximal uterine artery as well as now the placental artery, the artery that we're interested in, is that when you expose these rings to norepinephrine, there's a dose-dependent increase in stress. And this corrects for the size and thickness of the blood vessel, and that the pregnant exceed the non-pregnant in every instance. And this is because there's hypertrophic changes in the uterine artery of the sheep and in the human, and this is accomplished by increases in actin, myosin, and contractile proteins. Importantly, however, is that the third-generation uterine artery responds exactly like the placental artery does. So that if you get constriction proximally, you're going to get constriction distally as well. Now, is this new? Well, Elizabeth Ramsey, in some very elegant studies done at Carnegie Institute in the 1950s, actually demonstrated in the best model of human pregnancy, the rhesus monkey, since the placenta is alike, is that when you infuse hypaic and then epinephrine, you get differences in the patterns of these, what she called blushes, demonstrating that the proximal end, that is the spiral arteriole in the primate, responds to norepinephrine, and that the concept that the spiral arteries do not work is absolutely incorrect. And I think people are beginning to come back 360 degrees to this concept again, the placentologists. We then looked at human vessels, and these were also published at the same time that the sheep vessels. And you'll recognize that the pattern of the response is almost identical in the human uterine artery to that that's seen in the ovine uterine artery. And that is, there's a dose-dependent constriction, and it's greater in the pregnant than the non-pregnant artery. Now, what else have we learned? We've also learned, and let me first comment that this graph is incorrect, because the dependent variable is the umbilical vein ephedrine, which is on the x-axis and should be on the y-axis, and the independent variable is the maternal epinephrine, because what they're showing us is that as you infuse ephedrine into the mother and you get increases in the levels of ephedrine in the maternal arterial blood, that you then get increases in the umbilical venous blood that are equal to that. And this line actually is almost a line of identity. So it's transfused and you get a double whammy. You get vasoconstriction in the placental vasculature of the mother, and you get vasoconstriction in the body of the fetus, which includes the umbilical circulation. Another study that was done using the double perfused human placenta, where they take a cotyledon, they cannulate the maternal component, they cannulate the fetal blood vessels, and they look at pressure responses when they expose the maternal side of the placenta to ephedrine or phenylephrine. And in this particular case, they use phenylephrine and ephedrine. And you'll notice that in both instances, there was a dose-dependent or time-dependent increase in resistance in the fetal vasculature when it was exposed to maternal levels, if you will, of the vasoconstrictor. So it not only affects the mother, but it transfers into the fetal compartment, and this has been reported by several investigators, and therefore affects the fetal vasculature and the fetal placental perfusion. Now, this is to remind me to tell you that Dr. Chesley and his group in the 1960s demonstrated that in normal non-pregnant women, shown by the white line, that they had a dose response curve that was greater than the normal intensive pregnant woman shown by the yellow line. But when these women developed preeclampsia or pregnancy-induced hypertension, their responsiveness to these pressor agents, and in this particular instance, I'm showing you angiotensin II, increased significantly, and it actually exceeded the response in the non-pregnant woman. So women with preeclampsia or hypertensive disease have increased responsiveness to vasoconstrictors, and the same data can be found for epinephrine and phenylephrine in women as well as in sheep. Now, the issue with sheep is that they don't develop preeclampsia, so it's a unique model in the human, and so what we have to do is try and find the blood vessels of these women, which is nearly impossible, in order to be able to show correlations between the two species. So what are we talking about now? Well, Giacomo Meschia and Randy Wilkening published, I think, which is a very important paper, and they looked at the relationship between blood flow and oxygen content, which is uterine oxygen delivery, and fetal oxygen uptake. And what they showed that across a wide range of flows, and since content doesn't change in women, this could represent flow alone, that across a wide range of flows, there's actually no change in fetal oxygen uptake. So oxygenation stays very, very good. You can actually decrease flow 25% in a woman with hypertension with increased vascular resistance and not affect this. Or you can actually decrease it 50%. And the margin of safety is so great that, in fact, oxygen delivery remains the same and oxygen uptake remains the same. However, when you lay on top of that the effects of ephedrine, phenylephrine, or an alpha agonist now in a preeclamptic woman who may be at the 50th or 25th centile reduction, that what happens next is when you get a small change in blood flow, you get a precipitous drop in fetal oxygen uptake and delivery, and the fetus becomes hypoxic asphyxia. So this is an important observation to understand when you're looking at babies who have hypoxic encephalopathy. Well, are there clinical implications, and if so, what are they? Well, 30% of deliveries in the United States occur by cesarean delivery. Some hospitals actually 40 to 50%. 85% of women who undergo a cesarean delivery actually get regional anesthesia with epidural and or spinal. And interestingly, up to 80% of women undergoing spinal anesthesia or regional anesthesia will develop hypotension during the induction. And this is what's in the literature. So we are already looking at an at-risk population, and the question is how do you treat the hypotension? Maternal hypotension would then decrease uteroplacental blood flow in the maternal compartment because it's not necessarily autoregulated, and that would lead to a fall in placental oxygen delivery, fetal oxygen uptake, then fetal oxygen deprivation, distress, metabolic acidosis, and varying degrees of organ damage. So we're talking about a large population of women. 30% of the deliveries in our region, we have 40,000 deliveries in Dallas County. So 30,000 of those, 30% of those, 12,000, are going to deliver by cesarean section, and up to 80% of those are going to have regional anesthesia. Therefore, they're going to be at risk of undergoing an asphyxial episode and hypotension. So what is the treatment? Well, there's prevention. The OB anesthesiologist has tried to volume expand them, and we could spend an hour talking about its side effects. And some of them actually use prophylactic systemic infusions of either ephedrine or phenylephrine. So now you're giving it prophylactically, and we'll show at the end a study that did that and its effects. Or you end up treating it, and you treat with the infusion of the alpha agonist, ephedrine, or phenylephrine, in addition to volume expansion. So we're setting ourselves up for reducing placental perfusion and oxygen delivery in every woman with hypotension who requires a pressor. However, to date, there are no large population-based studies that adequately define the prevalence of maternal hypertension with regional anesthesia, nor do they examine the adverse effects in the treatment of maternal hypertension of these alpha agonists. Most of the studies that we found were about 200 to 300 patients. So we set out to evaluate the relationship between fetal outcome and maternal exposure to hypotension in the presence and absence of treatment with ephedrine and or phenylephrine in a large inborn population at Parkland Hospital, Dallas, Texas. Our objectives were to determine the prevalence of hypotension in women undergoing cesarean delivery with regional anesthesia, to determine the incidence of maternal hypotension that required an alpha agonist, to establish well-defined criteria that would describe the adverse clinical outcomes in neonates who are exposed to mothers with hypotension treated with alpha agonists. And our hypothesis, I think you can see where I'm going with this, it's been pretty clear, is that neonates exposed to maternal hypotension who received an alpha agonist would have a higher likelihood of poor fetal outcome as evidenced by an abnormal umbilical artery blood gas and the need for resuscitation and neonatal intensive care. The study design was retrospective, and we looked at 1,648 cesarean deliveries between August through December 2011 out of 5,065 births, so the 33%, there's your 30. We looked at multiple maternal and fetal data points, and we very carefully looked at the events prior to and during delivery that were related to the fetal well-being. And these are the data. So there were 1,466 babies, 89%, who had regional anesthesia with a cesarean delivery. So it meets what I give the numbers that I'd given you earlier. 69% of these women, 69% developed hypotension. And a quarter of that group responded to volume expansion alone. However, 70% of these women required volume and a pressor agent, either ephedrine and or phenylephrine. And that was divided up as over 500 of them getting ephedrine, 57 getting phenylephrine, and 156 required both, which means that they had, quote, refractory pressor effects. Now, I've already shown you the refractory pressor effects, and I've explained to you why they probably occur. So we define maternal hypotension as a systolic blood pressure fall of 20 millimeters of mercury or a systolic blood pressure of less than 100. We looked at volume expansion as more than 1 liter of lactated Ringer's. Preeclampsia was well defined as hypertension at the time of delivery, in all cases with proteinuria, and gestational hypertension occurred in the last third of pregnancy, and chronic hypertension presented in the first trimester or pre-pregnancy. We don't have time to go through the large amount of data that came out of these 1,500 pregnancies, so I've summarized them here. Women who had hypotension, 1,010, with regional anesthesia, had significant differences. They were older. They tended to be malliparous. They all tended to have hypertension, either preeclampsia, gestational, or chronic. Interestingly, they also had earlier delivery, usually at 35 to 36 weeks, and this is probably due to their hypertension, their preeclampsia. They were scheduled cesarean sections, generally with spinal plus or minus an epidural. They almost all received volume expansion, and 55% had a fall in blood pressure of greater than 20 millimeters of mercury. And both of the cases that I showed you, they both had that kind of fall from their hypertensive levels. And 36% also had a systolic blood pressure less than 100 millimeters of mercury. And I gave you an example of that. If we look at the fetuses now and we look at the neonates and their outcome, what I show you is that the babies delivered of mothers with hypotension receiving both pressors had a pH that was significantly less than all of the remaining groups. So these are the women who had what the anesthesiologists considered to be refractory hypotension, and they got multiple doses of ephedrine and phenylephrine, like I showed you with the second case, and they all had an average pH of less than 7.18. The babies who got ephedrine with their hypotension also had a lower pH, but nowhere near those values. Now, this is all of the babies that we looked at in the three groups that we were interested in. But I'm going to take you to a more specific population. And this is a busy slide, but I want to bring you down here. And on this slide are the characteristics of the controls, which are the first column, that is, no hypotension, no pressor, and those that had hypotension with both pressors. And these babies were all admitted to the NICU, and they all had mothers who received pressor therapy. And you'll notice that their mean pH, find my arrow again, was 716, PCO2 of 67, a bicarb of 22, a base deficit of minus 9, and their duration in the neonatal intensive care unit was 15 days. So it suggests to us that a lot of these babies ended up with hypothermia, and we're in the process now of doing a regression analysis to see if we can put all of this together. Well, Let's summarize these data. The greatest occurrence of significant fetal acidemia was in neonates that were exposed to maternal hypertension and both pressor agents. That 30% of neonates with both pressor agents had a pH of less than or equal to 7.15, and 20% of these babies had a pH of less than 7.01. So this is a significant problem. And it's interesting that we've had a series of cases over the last several years where both the neonatologist and now the anesthesiologist recognize that there's an issue. Since I'm the neonatologist and I talk to my faculty about what I think's going on, they go back and look and see, well, how much pressor agent the mother got. And those two cases that I showed you at the beginning, those two cases actually were in the last 12 months. I didn't have to go back very far to find them. And we've had two others in the last 6 weeks that are very similar. 18% of neonates with both pressures were also admitted. And we're not talking about small numbers. That's 142 babies. So we're talking about significant numbers of infants that can be affected in this phenomenon. So if maternal infusions of alpha-adrenergic pressors reduce maternal and fetal placental perfusion, and therefore fetal oxygen delivery and uptake, is there an alternative? Well, the curve that I showed you at the beginning for showing the effects of hypertension used angiotensin II. And that's where I began these studies in Dallas. And what we were interested in was defining the phenomenon that you see here where a normal non-pregnant woman, since we didn't have a model for hypertension or preeclampsia, a normal non-pregnant woman went from being sensitive to the angiotensin to being less sensitive, or as Chesley referred to it, refractory. And we repeated the studies that Chesley did in Toledo. And interestingly, the slopes of our curves for non-pregnant shown by the solid line and pregnant shown by the dotted line were identical to the slopes reported in the human. And the pressor effect, which is a 20 millimeter mercury rise, also was identical to what was reported in the human. So now we've given you several instances where the similarity between the human and the sheep is striking, and I'll give you several more, suggesting that the model is an excellent model in which to study human physiology. Now, what Ray Naden, a New Zealander, showed in our lab was very striking. And think about what I've already shown you about the alpha agonists. In this particular instance, we look at the relative changes in the uterine and systemic hemodynamic responses during intravenous infusions of angiotensin II in term-pregnant animals. Now you'll notice that the rise in systemic vascular resistance represented by the yellow dotted line exceeds the rise in uterine vascular resistance until you get to pharmacologic levels. Therefore, the rise in mean arterial pressure exceeds the increase in uterine vascular resistance. And guess what, folks? Blood flow goes up or is unchanged. So in the therapeutic range for blood pressure effects, you don't get a decrease in blood flow. So it's just the opposite of what I showed you with the alpha agonist. And this was a remarkable observation by Dr. Naden in our laboratory. And this has actually been confirmed using Doppler flow technology by investigators in Finland. Moreover, when we took blood vessels from sheep and we looked at the effect of angiotensin II on the uterine artery shown by the solid bar and the carotid artery shown by the open bar, there's a fourfold difference in the contraction, confirming the observation made by looking at total resistance. And then when we took blood vessels, like we did with the norepinephrine studies, and we compared norepinephrine with angiotensin II, look at the magnitude of difference in the contraction. Whoops. So that norepinephrine is a significantly greater vasoconstrictor, not only in the third generation uterine artery, but also in the placental artery, suggesting that maybe angiotensin II should be the pressor agent that we're using, since it has minimal effects in the ovine circulation. Well, what about the human? Guess what? Look at the curves. They're almost identical to the sheep. The difference is the amount of myosin and actin and hypertrophy that occurs in human uterine arteries is much less than that that's seen in the sheep. So when we look at the observations in women and sheep, we find that angiotensin II is highly sensitive in the systemic vasculature, and the uterine and placental vasculature is refractory. In contrast, the alpha agonist is just the opposite, weakly responsive in the systemic vasculature and highly sensitive in the uterine vasculature. Now, how do we explain that? Well, in 1992 or 93, people discovered there were two angiotensin II receptors. And I happened to be fortunate to be in the right place at the right time at this meeting where the three companies demonstrated that these were separate and different functioning types of receptors. And they gave me the reagents to use in my laboratory. The angiotensin I receptor is the classical receptor that induces a contraction and is what's found in the vasculature of adult animals. And the AT2 receptor does not induce a contraction. And some people say that at least in rodents, we haven't been able to actually demonstrate it in sheep or in humans, that it causes a relaxin response. What we find is it doesn't do anything. We must be missing something. Interestingly, in the fetus, the predominant receptor throughout the fetal body is the AT2 receptor, except in one organ, the placental artery. That is, the umbilical artery is all AT1, like in the adult and like in the peripheral vasculature of women and sheep. So that it plays a role in modulating placental blood pressure through the umbilical circulation. When we looked at the pregnant and non-pregnant sheep uterine arteries and binding, the predominant receptor, over 80 to 90% of the receptor was AT2. And this is not true in other tissues, and I'll show you. And the binding density doesn't change significantly in pregnant versus non-pregnant. So it remains AT2, explaining why angiotensin II actually might be the ideal pressor agent to use in pregnant women. When we looked at multiple arteries, and these are studies that were done by Blair Cox, who unfortunately died at an early age, was a wonderful comrade and collaborator in my lab. And what Blair was able to show, as demonstrated by the yellow, that in nulliparous, pregnant, and non-pregnant animals, the predominant angiotensin receptor in the uterine vasculature shown by yellow was the AT2 subtype, and in every other blood vessel that he looked at, it was AT1. So somebody set up a fail-safe system, because angiotensin II levels in pregnancy rise about twofold, and you wouldn't really want to be able to have an increase to maintain blood pressure and at the same time constrict the uterine circulation. So there is a pregnancy effect on uterine artery responses to all agonists, and it's lost in hypertensive women. Uterine responses to ANG2 are minimal in women and sheep in the uterus, and much less than the relative pressor effects. So it has a greater pressor effect than a uterine effect. In contrast, alpha agonists have greater effects on the uterine circulation of women and sheep than angiotensin, and they cause vasoconstriction at subpressor doses. The AT2 receptor is the predominant receptor in the uterine artery of women and sheep, another very strong correlation between the species. And it serves to protect this vascular bed from increases in plasma angiotensin II in pregnancy. So angiotensin II may be the best pressor to use in pregnant women with hypotension versus an alpha agonist. And I just want to finish up by showing you two papers that were done in the 90s using angiotensin II versus ephedrine in prophylaxis, so giving it before the woman developed hypotension. And you will note that in the presence of ephedrine in both the study on your left and the study on your right, that ephedrine caused metabolic acidosis, whereas angiotensin II did not. So there's some early evidence to suggest that, in fact, this is an ideal pressor for pregnant women. I'd like to thank you for your time and effort. This is a list of all of the people that worked with me on this in the last few years. And I want to thank NIH for the support in the McGregor Professorship as well. Now we have to move on to a randomized clinical trial of angiotensin versus ephedrine phenylephrine in order to be able to convince both the anesthesiologist and the obstetrician that this is the right drug and a safe drug. Thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.